Am I unmuted? There we go. There we go. Thank you, Tom, for asking me to speak here. This is really wonderful. I see old friends. I see people I've met recently through Zoom meetings, and a lot of people that I haven't yet met. But that's one of the beauties of this program. I am trying a new mic setup, so if it goes wonky, someone please stop me. Tell me. The last thing I want to do is irritate you for 45 minutes. When I talk, I always start with this story. I say it for my benefit more than yours, but you might enjoy it. This is more than 40 years ago now. I was speaking at the Monday Night Marina meeting in LA. And, it went well. I spoke, told my stories, talked for about 40, 45 minutes. They all applauded. I think they appreciated my effort, if nothing else. And then after the meeting, or when we come to close, everyone joined hands and they said the Lord's Prayer. Well, I didn't say the Lord's Prayer. It's a personal thing. I'm going to make a big deal of it. It's just not part of my tradition or part of the way I do things. So I bow my head and let them say the Lord's Prayer and everything was fine. And then after the meeting, we're mingling around and talking I'm talking to people. And a guy comes up to me, he's a newcomer. He comes up to me and he says, "You didn't say the Lord's Prayer." And so we started talking about it because it was not his tradition at all. And he was wondering if he belonged in Al-Anon because of this. And he and I talked about what this program is about. And I said, yeah, it's a partisan prayer in this non-denominational group, but you take what you like and you leave the rest. And that's not why we're doing this. And we shared some more and we both agreed that we'd stick with Al-Anon for a little bit longer. And I talked to some more people and then I went home. I'm driving home and I'm, how it is when you've done something like this. I'm driving home and I'm thinking of all the things I wish I had said and forgot. And I'm thinking of the things that I said and wish I'd said better. And then I thought, wait, I talked for 45 minutes and the only thing that guy heard was the one thing I didn't say. And there you've got it. I will say whatever it is I say for the next 40 minutes or so, and it's up to you to make sense of it. Hang on. I am a very lucky man. I am a very fortunate man. I know that. And the days when I forget how fortunate I am, those are going to be bad days. And the days I remember how lucky I am, how fortunate I am, those are generally good days. My parents raised us, me and my three sisters, with a love of the arts, books and movies and records. And my dad was an actor in the theater and a little bit on TV and movies. And there were always creative people around the house. The arts were very much a part of how I grew up. And on my business card today, it says writer, editor. I'm very fortunate. Every time we moved, and we moved a lot because, you'll hear the disease of alcoholism does that to a family. We moved a lot. And every time we moved, the first thing in was the books went up on the shelf and the paintings went on the wall and everything else just filled in around it. So I'm a very lucky guy. My parents, I was born in 1958, and I grew up through the 60s and 70s, and my parents were involved in a lot of the social movements that were happening during those times. And they showed us, me and my sisters, how that there are things worth fighting for, that you respect the dignity of people in front of you. And, you know, they really did a pretty good job. They really did. They did the best they could. I'm very fortunate. And then there was that other thing, that disease of alcoholism that tore through our family like a hurricane and nearly washed away all of that good. And there it is. We didn't see any newcomers. So you guys have all been around. I could stop right there and you all would just fill in the rest of the story. Because it's the same story. If you're new-ish in Al-Anon, I want to point out, they didn't ask me to speak because I got something special to say or a special way to say it. I'm just another example that this program works. I'm just another example that the disease of alcoholism doesn't have to be forever. Well, the disease is forever. The results of the disease don't have to be forever. And I'll tell you, the alcoholic in our family was my dad. And the way I work this program, the way I understand this program, it is very, very important for me to understand the disease of alcoholism, to as best I can get that down. And so if you've read the AA book, page 21, you know my dad, because on that page, it says, it talks about what they call a real alcoholic. That's what it says, page 21, a real alcoholic. I think my dad was kind of a little bit proud that he was, you know, that was what he was. He was a real one. On page 21, it talks about the Jekyll and Hyde personality. And I know that. I know that well. My dad was a university professor during the day and the town drunk at night. He was a loving, thoughtful father during the day and hell at night, just a monster at night. So I understand that Jekyll and Hyde personality. Also on page 21, it says, this kind of alcoholic, this real alcoholic, is rarely mildly intoxicated. They're usually more or less insanely drunk. And I understand that too. Because when my dad talked in AA, he would say that one was too many and an ocean wasn't enough. He would say that he never turned down a drink he thought he could get away with. And I saw my dad roaring drunk at home, in public, enough times to understand disgustingly and dangerous, or that rarely mildly intoxicated part. The other thing it says on page 21 is that this type of alcoholic is often disgustingly and dangerously antisocial. And that's my dad, who wrecked 12 cars in the course of his drinking, who got in bar fights, got arrested, He was not an easy drunk. A few years ago, I went back to that page in the AA book just to make sure that I was reporting it accurately. And there was a part that I had forgotten. It says there down at the bottom that these real alcoholics are often gifted people. They often have talents and charisma, but they would throw it all away for the next binge. And I saw that too. I saw that too. So I go through all of that because for me, it's important to understand what alcoholism is. Now, growing up, we started in New York, New York City is where I was born. We went to New Rochelle, where my dad was the English teacher at the high school. And he did the theater arts and put on productions. And they put on productions that got attention from the newspapers in town. They were good productions. We have somewhere squirreled away a record album of one of their productions. And they loved my dad. He was great for them. But they had a hard time with the drunk and his demands and his behavior. So he lasted there about 2.5, maybe 3 years. And if they could have kept the guy and fired the drunk, they would have, but they couldn't. So he got fired and we moved to Ohio. He got a job in directing a community theater in Lima, Ohio. And it was in Lima, Ohio. I'm about 7, 8 years old. I am now seeing and understanding the things that I'm seeing, the things that I'm hearing. And I see the fighting. And I feel that thing that goes on in alcoholic families. And I start, you know, doing what we do. And carrying it around and wondering why it happens like this. And my dad was very successful at that community theater. He got them more attention than they deserved. He was on television touting their productions and they did great. And he lasted there about 1.5 years because they loved him, but they had to fire the drunk because they just couldn't put up with it anymore. And we moved again, where he was a university. He was a professor of theater arts at Ohio Northern. And he lasted there about 1.5 years. And they loved him and all that he did, but they had to fire the drunk. And it was there that I started accumulating all that baggage that we come to this program with. And the things I heard and the things I saw and the trying to figure it out. Ada, Ohio is 1 mile by 1 mile. And it is a small farming town. And during those years, my dad was driving a Jaguar. It didn't have a muffler. So he would go on his drinking binge and then come home about 2:30 in the morning, and everyone in town knew my dad was coming home. And I remember that was when I started seeing the fighting and seeing the tension that was going on He got fired from ONU and we moved out to LA, came to California in 1968. By this time, his drinking was really taking a toll on his health and his mental state. He could still do theater, but it didn't seem he could do much else. And it was here that I started doing those things that make us good members of Al-Anon. I was about 8, 9, 10 in there, and I was doing it. I didn't have the textbook, but I was pouring it out and I was watering it down. That was back in the day when you could send the kids to the corner market for beer and cigarettes. And you know, I refused to go. And sometimes I'd offer to go. Maybe that would slow him down. And we cried at him. We cried with him. And we laughed at him. And we laughed with him. And we did all of those things to try and make him better. We thought that if we could just straighten that guy out, everything would be fine. But the kind of alcoholic my dad was, there was really no straightening him out. I remember moments that stuck with me for a long time. We took a trip to Catalina, 69, 70. And Catalina back then was just an island bar. And we went there and he drank from the moment we took off to the moment we landed 3 days later. He never stopped. And it was awful. And I remember we all got off the plane. It was one of those little 15-seaters. We all got off the plane except my dad. And the plane was leaning one way and he was leaning the other way. And it took him about 20 minutes to negotiate the 25 feet to get off that plane. And we're standing by the gate and I still see him. I remember the people who were waiting to get to take their vacation trip over to Catalina. And I can still see the contempt in their faces. I can still see how they looked at my dad. And I was holding his beer, so I helped him. I poured a little bit out of that. During this time, while all of this is going on, he's still working, he's still directing theater. He was working at the Shakespeare Society of America. And 1971, he puts me and my little sisters in the play. We were in The Tempest. And, you know, it was those last 71, January to June of 71, were just awful for too many reasons. One of which, we went to rehearsal and I saw my dad out in public. It was the craziest thing. With all the fighting and all the screaming and yelling that goes on in an alcoholic home, it never occurred to me that when he was home, he was on his good behavior. Because out in that theater with those actors, he was just an asshole. And he had a jug of wine that he had with him all the time, and he's drinking all night long. and trying to direct this play and insulting these professionals. And it was the word they use in the books, demoralizing. And I still could, I can still remember that sinking feeling of hearing those actors talk about my dad. We were, the routine then was to come home from school and wait for dinner, which was always a wreck. And we'll have dinner, have a fight, and he'd storm off to do some more drinking before the rehearsal started at 8. It wasn't until I heard him speak in AA that I learned why there was always a fight. See, we tried. I don't have to tell you people. We tried our best. Me and my sisters were on our best behavior. My mother made a meal that was beautiful and tasty and on time. And we did everything right. And there was always a fight, always. And it was when I heard my dad speak in AA that I learned why. He had to have a fight because he couldn't do his kind of drinking at home. He had to get out. So there was always going to be a reason for him to stand up, walk out, and start his evening. As I say, that last 6 months was just hell. And I could feel that excess baggage that we come to this program with, the resentments, that anger for things that should have been and it looked like never would be. The resentments over the promises broken, the showing up at the ball game, showing up here, and you know, alcoholism has its own agenda. His drinking took him into other places. Yeah, I might go back a few years because this is the kind of alcoholic we're talking about. When we went from New Rochelle to Ohio, my dad had gone 6 weeks earlier, found a house, got established, all of that. And then we took the train and he was going to meet us. Lima, Ohio, 1964. It was actually my birthday in 1964. And we pulled into the station, no dad. Find out later, he was at a bar. He stopped for one. He was coming to pick us up and he stopped for one and was telling everybody how proud he was and how pleased and how excited he was to his family was joining him here. And he just, alcoholism washes away the good. That's what it does. That's the kind of alcoholic we're talking about. Back to 71. I've got those resentments. I've got that feeling of hopelessness that a lot of people in Al-Anon know well. I don't know about other places, but other groups and other entities, but we sure got that one. To believe that it will not get better. To walk around every day knowing knowing in your heart that it won't get better. That's a terrible burden to carry around. That's a terrible burden for anyone. If you're 41 or 31, it may be I'm not going to say particularly bad, but that's a heavy one at 11. I have that resentment. I knew that hopelessness. And in June of 71, my dad got arrested again. We were living in West Hollywood, and he sat through three green lights, waiting for the right one, I guess. And he got arrested. And they wouldn't let him out of jail right away because he was, like I say, not a nice drunk. And those sheriffs in West Hollywood didn't appreciate it. But when he finally did get home, and my mother said to him, this is it. We're not doing this anymore. She'd probably said that 100 times, but this time she meant it. And she had called the Alcoholism Council to find out why. She still doesn't know why she called the Alcoholism Council, because she had never identified alcoholism as the problem. She just thought it was him. And the woman at the Alcoholism Council said to give him a phone number, ask him if he wants help. And he did. He was sick and tired of being sick and tired. The next day he went up to a 12-step house in Oxnard. He went to the 12-step house in Oxnard because he didn't want anyone in LA to know he was a drunk. And that Friday, my mother went to her first Al-Anon meeting. And Tuesday, me and my sisters went to our first Al-Anon meeting. That was June 1971. 50 years ago now, almost 51. That may not impress you, it impresses the hell out of me. If you've been around for a little while and you wonder why people stick around for so long, I'll tell you why. It keeps getting better. It keeps getting better. There's another good reason. I still need this program. Because in the course of living, alcoholics have come into my life. And if I'm not coming to these meetings and working this program, I will try to help them. And then everybody's got a problem. I keep coming to these meetings because I am so grateful for what I've learned here. And I've learned that if you don't give it away, you won't keep it. I learned that here. It is a spiritual principle. If you are not sharing it, you're not going to keep it. So if you've been around 10, 20, 30 years and think it's a long time, keep coming back. The first 50 years are the best ones. I can tell you from experience. I started going to the meetings. Started learning about alcoholism. I started learning about me, about how it affected me. Now, you know, I started coming to these meetings in the 70s. So I have a lot of old-fashioned notions, let's say. I do things the way I was taught. And it's worked for me. So I'm still here. So it couldn't have been all wrong. They told me to just come in and listen. They didn't say, you know, do you want to share? Why don't you share? Come on and share. Say something. Offer. They didn't bother me. They just said, sit down, listen. And I'm so glad that they did that. Because if they had tried to maybe push me into sharing, I might not be here today. But I listened to those people. And I listened to them talk about feeling the way I did, carrying that baggage that I carry. But then they started talking about the solutions. Then they started talking about how they felt today. And it was a whole different thing. It was a whole different thing. It is still today, still very important for me to understand alcoholism. We say the three C's and we throw it out very casually. And then we say, well, you know, you didn't cause it. You can't control it. You can't cure it. As if it's an obvious truth. And maybe it is. But I learned coming to these meetings, listening to AA's speak at open meetings, listening to Al-Anon speak in my meeting, Al-Ateens and Al-Anon speak in my meetings, that I learned that there's much more to those three C's than just cause, control, and cure. I didn't cause it. I had to learn that what that meant was nothing I did made my dad drink. Nothing. Not the good things, not the bad things. Because he was an alcoholic, and alcoholics drink. That's what they do. When we say you didn't cause it, it means you did not create that alcoholic. If you're a parent of an alcoholic, I just took you off the hook. There was nothing you could do to create an alcoholic. Nothing. My dad was just an alcoholic. That's the way God made him. But I had to learn that at a deep level. Can't control it. I tried. My mother tried. His mother tried. We all did. And we learned that alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful, and so are the alcoholics. Because when my dad needed to drink, there was nothing that was going to stand between him and the drink. And I learned here that it was never the amount. My dad was an alcoholic, and that disease makes him want to drink all the time. But it was never the amount that was the problem. It was the effect. It wasn't that he drank too much. It's that he became Mr. Hyde. It wasn't that he drank too much. It's that he became disgustingly and dangerously antisocial. What I had to learn here, it was never the alcohol. It was always him. It didn't matter if it was beer, wine, whiskey, or what. It was never the alcohol. It was always him. And so when he gets sober, he's still an alcoholic. And every conversation he had for the next 38 years, it was as an alcoholic, but he was sober. He was trying to live a good life. He was trying to live a sober life, but it was always going to be an alcoholic. And the cure part, you know, we want so much to fix these people. And if they, and you, how many times have you heard it in an Al-Anon meeting? I don't know how many times we said it in our house. If they would just listen, they'd be okay. But we can't do that. We treated the alcoholic like a problem. And that's not fair to anyone. That's not respect. There's no dignity when we're treating them as a problem. And so in my Al-Anon meetings and later in my Al-Anon meetings, these are the things I had to learn about alcoholism and about my role in this family disease for this program to take hold. The nice thing, neat thing, the fun part of all of that is that when I really understood alcoholism, everything here made sense. Before that, you know, I heard what you said. No, okay, I get it. But it didn't, it wasn't urgent. It wasn't vital. It wasn't important enough to change the way I spoke. It wasn't important enough to change my attitude until I understood alcoholism. And then it made sense. Then it made sense. This program is, well, I told you I'm a fortunate man. I am a fortunate man. I recognize that. I grew up going to these silly meetings and talking to you silly people. And I'm grateful for that. And there is so much I have learned along the way, so many experiences that have made a difference in how I go about the course of my day. Early on, in an early inventory, I wrote out that January to June in 1971, and just, you know, woke up at 7 and went to school and worried about the fight that was happened last night, and we're worried about the fight that's going to happen tonight, and worried about the divorce that's coming, the one that I want and don't want, all at the same time. And in that inventory, you know, I laid out it hour by hour. And you come home from school and you try to do your homework, but you really can't because you're still worried about the fight last night and the one that's going to happen at dinner. And then you have dinner and there's a fight. And then you go to rehearsal and that's a mess. And you rehearse until 10:30 or 11. And then a few times there, you know, my mom wanted my dad to come home after rehearsal. So we would go up to the Sunset Strip to the Rainbow Bar and Grill and try and pull my dad back out, and take him home. And we'd get home at 2:30 and fight until 4, go to sleep, wake up at 7, and go to school. And when I looked at that inventory, I realized that the way I got here was one day at a time. That alcoholism is those big, dramatic moments, but it is also that daily grind, that every day losing more dignity, more self-respect, more hope in the future, losing every day. And I realized that that's how I would get better, one day at a time. And since that inventory, feeling has stuck with me, that as long as I do my best today, I'm going to be all right. And I'll make tomorrow better. And I'll just keep doing that. And I'll work my way back to health. My dad was 2.5 years maybe into this program. And I was going to a couple of the Alateen meetings around, and I wanted to go in particular to Brentwood. There was only one way to get there, and that was with my dad in his MG, which has got to be the smallest car ever made. 2.5 years in, and I don't want to play this down. 2.5 years in, I was still having a lot of trouble being in the same room with the alcoholic. 2.5 years into this thing, I was hanging on to my resentments a lot more than was healthy, but no one was talking me out of them yet. But I wanted to go to that meeting. And, you know, that was one of those first times that the program became more important than whatever it was I was feeling. And I'll tell you something, this is the truth. That has gotten me further than almost anything else, when this program was more important than how I was feeling. Whether I was too tired or not enough time and not even interested, when the program was more important, I got better. You said it was La Cañada, and I immediately remembered. My mother and I were asked to speak at a meeting in La Cañada. And we drove the 30 miles up into the mountains, up 3 stoplights past forever. And we got there, and there were 4 people. So we spoke, we told them, what it was like, what happened, what it's like now, how much we love this program. And we hope that they would keep coming back. And so when you said La Cañada, I thought, oh my gosh, I don't think I've driven further to talk to fewer people than that night. But it was that this program was more important than that. And, you know, if there's justice in this world, one of those people needed to hear us. So I go to Brentwood with my dad. And we drive the 45 minutes from West Hollywood to Brentwood in complete silence, because we don't have anything to say to each other. And anytime we try to say something to each other, it's a fight. It's still that way, 2.5 years in, because neither one of us had really learned how to talk to each other. Neither one of us had really grown up to the point where we could have a conversation. But we'd go to Brentwood, and I would go have dinner, because he went to the workshop. And at 8:30, my meeting started and his meeting started. And then I would meet him back at the at the meeting at 10, and we were there probably until 11 because his sponsor had him talk to everybody. And then we would drive home. Well, my dad's an actor, and he learns lines very quickly. On the drive home, he would tell me what the main speaker said, pretty much word for word. And it would take almost the whole trip home. And then we would park and go in. And week after week, it was the same thing. On that drive home, he would tell me what the main speaker said. I started listening. And, you know, after a while, we would laugh at some of the predicaments that alcoholics get themselves into. And we'd cry when they got sober, because, you know, that's what makes us cry. And I started to understand the alcoholic. I was listening to him talk about the things he loved, the things that were important to him. I didn't interrupt him. I didn't offer my opinion. I didn't give him my perspective. I didn't say anything. But I learned more on those rides home about the alcoholic than I ever could of any other way. I'm looking at the time, and I'm 11 years of alcoholism. That's pretty quick. 50 years of Al-Anon, that takes some editing. I have to think about what I'm going to say next. I was lucky. I've been a lucky man my whole life. I was lucky then. I got involved in service and met some of the smartest, most acute thinkers I've ever met. We would go, I was talking about this just the other day. We would go to Maywood City Hall. I don't think any of you here had to go to Maywood City Hall to the, now we go out to Glendale where it's nice. You should have been, we were upstairs in a room in Maywood. And that's where World Service and the Intergroup was. And I met some of this, just, I learned so much in those meetings and doing service. And I was on the World Service, on the board for a couple of years. I was the Alateen member. And started doing convention committees and things like that. If you're shy, if you're thinking you don't quite belong, if you've got doubts, volunteer, take a job. It changed the way I looked at things. It made me feel a part of everything that was going on. And I still do that today. It became a lifelong habit. I still do that today. When I got to 19, we move Alateens. We like to think they move to Al-Anon at that time, but it doesn't happen very often. We had a 60th birthday party for a guy who I was in Alateen with. And there were like five of us there. And we were talking about all of the people we never see anymore. But I started going to Al-Anon. And, you know, the transition to Al-Anon for me was really kind of seamless. By then, I knew a lot of people in Alateen and in Al-Anon. the meetings that I started going to, it was really easy. I'm trying to think of what can come next here, because there's so much that to talk about. I will tell you this, and this is not for publication. I started being an Alateen sponsor. I don't recommend that, but it worked out for me. And it worked out for me because I hadn't been in Alateen meetings with those kids. So they didn't associate me with their meeting. But I started I got a co-sponsor, and she and I made a pretty good team. I went away to school and came back, and we started sponsoring again at a meeting, and you know how that goes. Pretty soon we were dating, and we've been married 37 years now. So now you see, the reason that's not for publication is that I can't guarantee that you're going to find the love of your life in Alan. But it has happened. Bits and pieces. When I 2008, my son, our son, was in Alateen, was on the SCAC committee, and they asked me to speak at the transition meeting. At SCAC, they have a meeting where they like to try and persuade Alateens who are getting older to go to Al-Anon. So that was my job that year. And they asked me in January, and I was just flattered. You know, that was really sweet of them to ask me. But that year I was working at a newspaper, and that was a terrible year for newspapers, and that one in particular. A lot of rumors about, you know, big time layoffs and things started. The SCAC was in July. Rumors started in May. So, I mean, this was terrible atmosphere. Terrible. It was depressing every day. But we're here, and there's going to be big layoffs. A lot of people gone. And Debbie and I are trying to figure out, you know, well, what do we do if that happens? And we didn't have any answers. We just kept coming up with the question, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And July comes, and, you know, we still don't know, but I got this thing. I got to go out to Riverside to speak on a Sunday morning to these kids about moving into Alateen or moving into Allen. So I go, and I had been thinking about this. And so I talked a little bit to them about moving from Alateen to Al-Anon and how important that was. But it occurred to me that what we do here is that transition from sickness to health. And I talked to them a little bit about that transition from thinking poorly, from having bad information, from having a bad attitude, and leaving that those habits behind and becoming a healthy person. And as I was speaking, as I was saying the words, it occurred to me, this job thing is another transition. It's not going to be a problem because we know how to do that. That's what we do. And Monday, the kids appreciated my effort. They applauded. Half of them were asleep, but that's okay. Monday afternoon, I go into work. I don't even put down my lunch. The phone rings. Get called upstairs. I'm fired. But it didn't cause a panic. And I went home and I told Deb, you know, okay, the question, what are we going to do now, needs an answer. What are we going to do now? We didn't panic. We didn't sell the cars and we didn't sell the house. We didn't sell the kids. We talked to our sponsors and we took it one day at a time and we figured it out, and it really worked out for the best. 9 months later, I got the job I have today, which is 12 years ago. But it had to do with Al-Anon. It had to do with the habits I've developed here. And so I keep that in mind, that when I was in the drinking years, I developed that. I had bad information. I thought we could fix this guy. I had bad habits of thought, of action. Slamming doors is really no way to communicate. And then we make that transition. We learn new habits. We come to these healing places. And we learn how to grow up. The alcoholic, my dad died in 2009. When he died, he was 38 years, 5 months, and 6 days sober. We know exactly. He drank for about 17 years, more or less. We're not really sure, but we know exactly how long he was sober. Because every one of those days counts. Every one of those days, we try to get better. Every one of those days makes a difference. And it's the same for us. Every one of those days. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. They took my dad and they made of him everything that we wanted to make of him. And I love Al-Anon because without this program, without you people, I would have missed it. He could have made all of those changes. He could have become the guy he was, which was pretty good. And I would never have seen it. Al-Anon opened up my eyes and it opened up my heart to the possibility that that drunk could be a good guy. And I wouldn't have seen it if it hadn't been for you. If you hadn't given me the tools to grow up. One last thing. Whoops. I mentioned that I a lot of old-fashioned ideas that I learned a long time ago. I guess that's just how we are. But one of them is that the fifth tradition really, really does tell us some important things. Why we're here, we only have one reason: to help families of alcoholics. That's it. We're not here to find God. We're not here to be saints. We're not here to save the world. We're just here to welcome families of alcoholics. And we do that by practicing the 12 steps, by understanding and encouraging the alcoholic, and by giving comfort. And I keep that in mind. We try to do so much sometimes. We try. The phrase in our literature, these well-meaning people, I love that. We are well-meaning people. But I think about that fifth tradition. And it takes me back to early years. We came in as a family, and that wasn't usual back then. I don't know how usual it is today, but we would speak together, and it would be my dad, the alcoholic, my mother, the Al-Anon, me and my two sisters, the Alateens. And, I think most of the time we did okay. I think sometimes we didn't do so good, but we tried. And we got asked to speak at Haven House, which is a shelter in Pasadena, a shelter for battered families, but alcoholism is more often the reason than not. A parenthetical note. I told this story not too long ago at a meeting here in Torrance, and one of the women came up afterward and said that she had been in Haven House. She hadn't been there this night, but she had been there, and she knew how important the work they do is. So we all spoke at Haven House. And my dad told his story briefly, my mother briefly, and us briefly. And we closed it, and then we were talking to people and answering questions, just milling about. And one little guy was tugging on my dad's jacket. He's the son of an alcoholic. He's got a big black eye, and he's shy. And he says to my dad, "Did you ever feel bad for the things you did?" Well, after my dad composed himself, he explained alcoholism. He told the kid how, alcoholics don't mean to hurt the people they love. It's this disease, they can't help it. And we talked to them for a little bit longer when we went home. I like to think, when I look back on that, that we were faithful to that fifth tradition, that we were carrying the message, and we were understanding the alcoholic in our families, and that we gave some comfort to a family that way. It doesn't get any better than that. I don't know what if we want anything more. I love this program. It has meant everything to me. And I hope I get to see all of you again. Thank you.